Hi everyone, you're about to listen to part two of our interview with Allison Head from Project Information Literacy. If you haven't listened to part one, check out episode 28 to hear the beginning of this interview. Okay, back to our interview with Allison.
So let's talk about the future of media literacy instruction. What might the future of media literacy instruction look like? Because recently I went to a great session at the Critical Library Pedagogy conference. I mentioned it in a recent episode. And someone said, you can't sift or crap your way out of QAnon. And if that's not an amazing quote for just everything we're living through, I mean, I don't know what is. But, you know, so it got me thinking like, okay, well, where do we go now, right? Like you said, crap was a great framework for where we started. But now we've evolved a lot and there's a lot more nuance that we're dealing with. So where do we go from here, basically?
And how we run into this even in our Smart Talk series, a really nice woman, an expert that I knew at Harvard from the Berkman, was going to do something on deep fakes. And she had some high appointment in some agency somewhere. And she said, I can't really do interviews, but I could do it this year when I'm not working anymore. It was some prestigious fellowship. And I thought, I'd like to go back to her because she was so receptive, but are deep fakes really still part of the conversation? I use that as an example. I mean, they are, but are they cutting edge enough? Originally, when I talked to her last year, it was like, this is like the coolest thing and we should really look at this, and she's the person to go to. It gives you an idea. I think that example gives you an idea of how quickly these tricks are evolving and how quickly media is evolving. And I think I do like that Mike Caulfield, who is the person that came up with SIFT as a heuristic, and Weinberg has talked about civic reasoning, online reasoning. Everybody frames it up differently. In a report that we did, actually, a paper we did in First Monday, we talked about the importance of news as a social practice. In the sense we also, we've used that a lot, the socialness of research, that you turn to people and peers. We've talked about this idea in terms of media literacy, which is just an expanding concept to try to get your arms around and make it relevant and applicable to teach or even to have a course called media literacy. And I think thinking about media literacy or media as something, a couple of things, where should it go? What is the future? I can identify the questions, I think, better than I have the magic strategy here. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the question is, I think, to recognize the socialness of news. We argue that in the First Monday piece in terms of teaching news. This is rather startling. In our news engagement study, one of my favorite findings is that students got their news, 70% had gotten news from a classroom discussion, usually initiated by the professor. Yes, it could have happened in office hours, but follow-up interviews look like it was the classroom. This is the old classroom. However, it could start, it could also happen in Zoom. And I think what that tells you is it's emblematic of the power that higher ed and professors have in framing those discussions. And unfortunately, what we found was that those discussions only went so far. Students didn't know, I'll act like a student, is that going to be on the test? Or is that just, you know, kind of an icebreaker? That you're telling me what the news is and you're gonna take it in a different direction. In other words, it lacked the scaffolding for teaching it as some sort of concept. I think that's one thing that has to happen in the field of media literacy, is to embrace the idea that news media is highly social. And in the sense that we found that in the 2010 study with evaluation that when students looked at a resource, they may have used some crap-like criteria, but they often turned to friends and said, what do you think of this? And I think that's a big component of media literacy and where it's headed is to think of it in a different, I'm not talking about social media, but it's certainly an aspect of it. But this idea of the socialness of news. I think the other thing, and Mike Caulfield, I think the SIFT founder, I think in talking about media literacy talks about, it's not really media literacy. He calls it quote unquote media cynicism. Mm-hmm. And this is something that the Knight Foundation, when they supported our study, our 2018 study, had just been chasing with Dana Boyd's group at Data and Society with Amanda Linhart and Mary Madden had done a big piece about trust in young people. It's also something that we looked at in the 2018 study because fake news had become more predominant and was becoming a household name at the time. And what we found was, I think Mike Caulfield's onto something. I agree with him, trust and not only credibility, but this concept of trust of media is broken. As we know, it's more broken in surveys, more than ever, more people distrust news, especially in the age group that we teach and that I study. And so there is a certain amount of cynicism. How do you break that down? And here's the statistic that is stunning from our survey, almost 6,000 students in 2018 about news engagement, is that 36% of that sample, it's more than a third, say, I don't believe any news because of the threat of fake news. And I think media literacy needs to do something about the lack of trust. I agree with Mike Caulfield, the media cynicism. You both teach the overuse of the word bias. It's mm-hmm. even that quote that I, you know, and not everything's biased. How do you unpack that? And I think those are some interesting questions that need to be asked around that. I think the approach that we take, just as a final point, I think the approach that we take in the series in looking at the shape of news as a methodology that students can use and practice to get the big picture. It's where you started, Jessica, and you said, we just don't do this. We look at a single source and we drill down. And we ask a student to evaluate it within that context. And I'm not sure that that is always the best way to go for complex topics. And we are in a very complex information space at this time. I don't think anybody would dispute it. So I think that's one really useful tool. And I think something we haven't talked a lot about in this interview is the visual messaging. How, and not so much, we do touch on this, you know, how did these visuals frame up the discussion and the feelings that people had? What power does the press have in eliciting certain responses? Well, certainly intentionally sometimes, but a lot of times unintentionally. And how do visuals, since the world is so visual, it's so image-centric, how do we begin to unpack that as well as with the words? How do those two pieces go together? So I think it's an exciting time to talk about media literacy. I think new tools are needed though.
Yeah, there's been a few papers and presentations that I've checked out recently on epistemology. Yeah. And it reminded me of that when you were talking about, you know, bias, how we just overuse it so much. And this idea right. that just because something's biased doesn't mean there's not truth in it. And how do we unpack the real root of bias and what it really is and how we all approach knowledge and the development of knowledge in a different way. That's another key term you brought up before as well. So I'm trying to, as I'm developing my own media literacy instruction for the future, you know, how do we know what we know and how do I know what I know versus what you know, and that they're so different.
Well, what's my bias and what's your bias? And
right.
How much bias is acceptable?
Exactly.
And how is the bias? I was a rhetoric major as an undergrad. It's all my stuff. you know, what is the intent of the bias?
Right.
What kind of appeal is it? You know, is it pathos? Is it ethos? Is it logos? What's it appealing to? And how is the story framed? Those questions are, they've always been fascinating. I mean, right. Since Socrates' time, and I think we're still really grappling with that. But you're right. I mean, it's a knee-jerk response when we go into focus groups. Students always, you know, to get a rise out of me as the PI doing the focus group, you know, it's like, because it's biased and I don't believe any news. And, you know, it's like, certainly not all news is biased.
Right.
But there are people that think that it is. And I think that's incredibly problematic for where we are, and especially as a democracy, and thinking back to what Weinberg says about the importance of civic engagement and how mm-hmm. do we their information literacy. And, you know, if there wasn't enough for you to do, now creeping into your profession is, well, you have to create more informed citizens on top of it and make them more civically minded and engaged. But I think that election and the turnout might bring you good results. Because I think youth will turn out more than before. But yeah, they're really interesting questions. And Dana Boyd had, it was an essay that from Data and Society that was widely read about media literacy. And really,
I think that's one of the things I read, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. I read it again prepping for this. And, you know, she's like, the way forward is unclear, it's hazy. This is such a complicated, and this is Dana Boyd saying that, this is such a complex, complicated space. And our old methodologies don't work, like so much. I mean, we're really in just a whole different time.
And I think that article was about 2 years ago, so it hasn't gotten any better.
It was, and you know, we were interviewing Renee Hobbs at the time for one of our Smart Talks, who is from Rhode Island and leads the Center for Media Literacy. It's really well known. And you know, the question was, were we going to ask her about Dana Boyd's essay? And because, I mean, there was really some reaction to that. But I think it would be hard to carve yourself out as a media literacy person today and really get your arms around what that is and how you would teach that to students. Especially when you look at news itself, I'll just end on this note, this blending, and it's been a consistent problem in the COVID study, as well as we heard it in 2018 in the news study, this blending in news of opinion and fact. I mean, it's blended so much that we don't have these finite sections like the opinion page or op-ed page. And the front page, we don't have the package anymore. And social media takes fragments of news and adds another layer. So, you know, it's a really challenging question. I'm glad you asked me. I don't have the, I would never go out on the limb and say, here's the answer.
Right.
I really loved Report 2. I love this whole idea of visual storytelling. I think it's definitely something I haven't explored a lot in my instruction. I do touch on it, you know, when it's appropriate, where I talk to students about how charts are graphed to skew your perception of a story, and how, you know, news sources just kind of, they don't always interpret information and statistics accurately, but they do it just enough so that it's still considered accurate, but it's definitely skewing the story, mm-hmm. especially because students are so visual. But I love this idea of the images and how it tells a story, and how it plays on people's emotions. It's definitely something I haven't explored, and I look forward to it because we are very visual. Our students are very visual, and I think it also goes into, they're so quick to share visuals that, you know, I want them to be more informed about the visuals that they're sharing.
Right.
Well,
I mean, the visuals, that second report, it was funny when we finished the first one, The Shape of News, especially Stephen Braun's graphics that he had spent, he redid those so often, and you know, just every nuance, it's just this brilliant perfectionist, teaches at Northeastern in Boston, and teaches in this particular area as well as has a science background. So, you know, the accuracy and not inferring different things, which gets at some of your points around the chart in the scaling, is it really representative over time? But once we got to report two, it was like, we loved report one so much because we work really closely together and we loved report one. It was like, oh no, report two, will it ever, I have to admit I'm the Eeyore, will it ever be as good as I loved report one? And the visual messaging and the coding of those images and then pulling out those 15 images, they were really there. And Stephen, you know, created that heat map that shows how, or actually it was a bubble map, it's many different things, it's beyond talented, but he did a bubble map and it shows, you know, fear runs throughout those first 100 days. And if you think about it, people were walking around with fear. And I think the overlay extending with what's going on from the journalism perspective of, this was the impossible story to cover. And we talk about what news photographers do and put themselves in the middle of stories. And here they were, for safety reasons, using telephoto lenses and distant from the story. And newspapers were in this horrible bind. They knew they had to get beyond just running images of the blob. You know, the spiky blob from CDC, which is actually just kind of an artistic depiction of a rendering of, to make it kind of exciting in 3D. It doesn't look like this at all. But they had to somehow get images. And Margie McMillan, the librarian, one of the librarians on the project said, I'm going back to tintype. I'm gonna see whether these images ran before. How old are these images? And we found actually quite a few were. There was a certain percentage that, they were stock shots. I mean, it gives you an idea of how that story was framed when you picked it up. And I love the exercises around that. I know when I've taught new media students, you're right. You know what you're saying, Amanda, students relate to images in deconstructing them. I think it's more their world than text. Mm.
For our final question, can you talk a little bit about what was the most interesting finding for you personally?
Okay, that's easy. I have a master's in journalism, so I'm always really interested, you can tell from this interview, in the journalism industry and what's happening. We end up looking at, just bear with me for a minute, we start with 66 news websites, and they're really diverse. And in the second part of that first report, we say, well, who is producing the most news? And we find the majority of the news, and I think it was around 63% or 66%, was being produced by 12 different news outlets and in our sample. And that amounted to about 75,000 stories in the first 100 days. Out of 125. So they were really the big players. If somebody had bet me who was on that list, I would have said New York Times, Washington Post, I'm showing my age, just these real mainstream national papers. I think what surprised me is the role of local papers, which is good because there's a lot of concern about local news and will local news survive. And it certainly does a different job there on the ground. The Seattle Times, which makes sense because that's where the first COVID case that we know of was first diagnosed, but also San Francisco Chronicle comes in the top 12. But what comes in first is not the New York Times. And this is the amount of news. It's not the amount of words, because New York Times would always probably come in first because they always run such long, thorough stories and incredible coverage. But what comes in first is the top three are Business Insider, And then next is CNN and then Fox. And they're producing the most news. And again, this isn't the quality of news. This is the most stories. This is mm-hmm. the unit that we're measuring. And the Business Insider is really interesting because what we end up calling it is, we call it, a new digital resource, because it doesn't have a building. It's not in New York City like the New York Times. So we see this rise of these digital publications leading the charge here. I mean, admittedly, this is a business story first. It's how it breaks. That's the first thing that puts Business Insider out there. They have people on the ground in Asia because they often cover those markets. So that helps explain it. But at the same time, they're just churning this news and these briefs. The analysis, from a librarian point of view, was so interesting because newspapers and news websites are constantly updating. So we had to really make sure the cleaning of that data was so difficult. That probably took the most time from Media Cloud, from MIT, actually. So Business Insider, just to walk this back for a second, ends up producing twice as much news articles as New York Times in the first 100 days. So they're all over this story, and CNN, but Fox as well. Now, we don't dive into the quality because of the shortness of the reports, but there has been research that's come out that's looked at left versus right coverage. But we really saw a mess. So I think, that was my surprise finding. You could have knocked me over. Business Insider, this digital kind of out of nowhere at one point resource is the one that's reporting the story first. And also that Fox News, what we often hear in focus groups at certain institutions when we go out in the field is students will say, I go to Fox News for my news. And I think the mix of both liberal leaning and conservative leaning, and that's how readers can actually define these different news publications. We're very careful about that. You get this real mix here. And also HuffPo is in the list. So it's a real diversified list. And I think there's surprises. Mainstream news, big nationals aren't there.
Right.
When they may have the most resources, even though they're hurting these days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Business Insider has come up a lot in when I'm looking for resources to use as examples in the classroom. No matter what I search for, they come up in one of my DuckDuckGo searches. And it's like, in the beginning, I had to kind of figure out who they were. Because like you said, it was like kind of a little bit of a newcomer. It doesn't have the longstanding reputation of like the New York Times or the Washington Post. So it was like, who are these people?
Yeah. And I really on a final note, because this can't go till midnight, but on a final note, it's interesting how we teach students to think about news. And when we did the algo study, we interviewed faculty, 37 faculty, and when they talked about algorithms influencing news that they got and information, they were just adamant about, well, I go to NPR.
Mm.
I go to New York Times. They don't collect my personal information, which, of course, is not entirely accurate,
right.
Depending on how you got there. But these single source readers, when really what you find is younger readers don't experience the news landscape like that at all.
Yeah, that's true. Very true.
Yeah. And Business Insider makes perfect sense to them, as well as something we've always chased at PIL is currency. We know currency is so important to students, no matter what kind of paper, what's the most recent thing? And there was Business Insider.
So what I have questions that are in the learning resources, I never would have thought to give an assignment to compare stories from two different dates, right? One near the start and one near the end, and how things have changed, and how those differences are perceived by the student versus other students, and how that impacts how we all experience the entire news story. So, you know, that's just one example of some of the questions, but definitely the learning resources were a huge takeaway for me personally.
Yeah, I gotta give credit to Margie McMillan, Elena Ball, and also Barbara Pfister, was our internal peer reviewer, and then she added slides actually because of LMSs. You're just trying to anticipate, what do librarians need in the time of COVID to talk about COVID and to teach this, and how can they integrate it, and how can they, let's be honest, convince faculty that this is really an incredible series for them to apply. And there was so much discussion about those learning resources that went into that, and that we wanted them to be broad. We didn't want to dictate, you know, you need to do this, and then once you do this, follow this process. And Jessica Yurkowski, who was on the project, who is a librarian. I knew her from the design school at Harvard and the Meta Lab, where we both were at Harvard as well. We worked on several projects together. But she always does those wonderful drawings, and she did the algo study drawings as well. And to really frame up context and what these, in fact, we decided to make those available on the landing page for instructors, faculty, librarians that wanted to use those different images as a way to convey the thinking that goes into unpacking what these resources meant. What's interesting is Elena, whose first year experience at UW-Tacoma, and then Margie, they both did the coding on the visual messaging. So they were so close to it. And both are really passionate about students. And working with students. And I think, and Barbara Pfister as well. And I think it really came through. But I think they would admit it took forever, like good assignments do. Mm-hmm. I've got to hand it to Barbara. She came up with the ethics for photographers, the ethics for journalists. Do these stories work within those constraints? And I think that's a fascinating evaluation tool for a student to learn. I mean, that's like something you'd learn in a master's program or a doctoral program of, you know, I'm going to really analyze this. They fell short here or there. And but to be able to have an undergrad go through that kind of experience is unique. And again, maybe another piece of the media literacy. It certainly shines light on what that profession is about and what their standards are.
Okay, so thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and chat with us. We will share all of the resources that you talked about, especially the report, in our show notes, as well as on our Twitter page. And we hope everybody takes the time to look at both reports and starts implementing as soon as they can. And Allison, if they want to reach out to you, where can they find you?
Okay, projectinformationliteracy.org, and they can find me at projectinfolit.org. We also have a Twitter page as well, which we'll put this interview up on, and happy to get the word out. And then I can be reached directly at allison@projectinfolit.org. One L, Irish spelling.
All right, great. Thank you so much. Okay, well, I enjoyed that conversation with Allison. How about you?
Yeah, that was great. So many good ideas. And you know, this topic is always on top of mind for me. I love talking about news and misinformation and the media and things like that. So definitely interesting.
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed it. I definitely can't wait to implement some of these ideas into my instruction. And I think we'll be using these examples for a very long time, in many semesters to come, for sure.
Right, definitely.
I think what I liked most about it was that students can relate to it. It's something that they lived through. So they'll be a little more engaged when we talk about it.
Right.
So now's the time in the show where we transition to a recommendation, a triumph or a fail. So what do you have for us today, Jessica?
So I have a triumph and a fail. So my triumph is finally getting to create a Padlet for the first time. I've always known how it worked, but I've just never implemented it. It's always been something that's been kind of on the back burner. And then, you know, COVID and everything, and I just never felt comfortable. I wanted to get comfortable with live online instruction before I implemented Padlet. And now that I'm much more comfortable on Zoom teaching, I finally am ready to do it. So tomorrow I have a class that I'm going to be teaching using Padlet for the first time, and I'm really excited to see how it goes. And because I'm crazy, I'm going to be doing breakout rooms for the first time as well at the same time. So we may have a fail for next episode. Let's see how this goes. And my fail is, so last night I tried to go on and do a Twitter chat with Katie from our last episode with hashtag CripLib.
I tried to do it.
Oh, you saw me on there trying. I got in my introduction and one tweet and a like, and then like my son just lost his mind going to bed, and it was like, yeah, I can't. Like, I'm trying to talk to him and then get a tweet in and then talk to him and get a tweet in, and I'm like, forget it. I just can't do it. So I had to mom and got in the way of my Twitter chatting, unfortunately, but I'm going to try again next time. We'll see.
Yeah. That's definitely a challenge. I think there were actually two Twitter chats going on in our field. There was the LIS Pro chat was going on last night, and the CripLib chat too. So I had high hopes that I was going to participate, but then life, man.
Right. Exactly. And it's really hard to do. I always think I'm going to be able to do those chats while doing other things. And it really does take a lot of mental energy, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just, it's because you're really engaging and listening to what other people are saying and trying to put in thoughtful responses. So it is something that you really got to put on the calendar and sit and think about.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting is they do tweet out the questions ahead of time. They put it on right. their websites, but then like, it just seems like you're not really having a conversation, that you're just having like, you're sending out canned messages. So it's kind of like, you know, maybe in the beginning, that's what you do. You know, you think about the questions, you write it out, and then you just copy paste. And then once you get a little more comfortable with responding in that pace, then you stop doing that. That might be a tip for people who want to get involved in Twitter chats.
I might try that next time, because I definitely am a reflector. Like, that's why I was never good in the classroom. You know, like I remember in high school, I had a teacher who told my parents that if I wore lighter colors, I would blend into the back wall of the classroom. Like, really nice thing to say to my parents, first of all. But that, I mean, she was kind of right. It's like, I was super quiet because I needed time to think about things, and I still am. And so I think that might be a way to help me conceptualize the ideas and reflect and think. And then even if I don't use those responses, at least I've been able to think about it, and I can maybe engage more in the conversation that's happening.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah, so I have a fail. So, I feel like I'm like the reigning like queen of fails on the podcast lately. I feel like everything is a fail. I listen to this parenting podcast and they do triumph or fails. And there's another person on there who's like, I have another fail. And she's like, this is like my seventh fail in a row. And I feel like the same way. So my fail is that I am, as I think I talked about last week as my previous fail, we are not getting as many submissions for our virtual conference. But my fail this week is that I wasn't thorough enough, I guess, in asking the technical details about formatting for our breakout sessions. And I think we're going to have to go to this new concept, to me at least, called SimuLive, where it's going to be pre-recorded sessions. So I think my fail is that I didn't look into it. And now because of that, I have to go back to presenters and tell them that they're not going to be live. So I'm a little concerned. I know if I was a presenter, I would be like, oh, I don't know if I want to do this now. And, you know, our submission rate is already low. So I'm a little nervous. You know, I'm really when I took over this conference, I really wanted to be more transparent. I was all about transparency. And I feel like I wasn't able to be transparent this time because I didn't ask the right questions. But it happened really quickly deciding to go virtual. So, you know, these weren't the questions I was asking. I was asking all these other questions. So we'll see how it turns out. But I think that was my fail of not even thinking about this option. I'd never even heard of it. I just assumed everything would be live. So I don't know. We'll see. I might have another fail for you or maybe a triumph in the future. Who knows?
Right. Yeah. It just seems like a miscommunication that maybe couldn't have been avoided, but you know, it still feels crappy in the meantime.
It does. It feels crappy because it's like, there were so many things that I asked about the platform. We're using vConference. So it's more sophisticated than Zoom. It's way more sophisticated. And I had so many questions about it. Like, probably like 20 questions, you know, this wasn't one of them.
Of course.
So it's like, epic fail.
Right. Exactly. It happens. So let's see, maybe next time will be a triumph. You'll break your streak.
Hopefully. Well, stay tuned, folks. Another cliffhanger.
Right.
So that wraps up another episode of The Librarian's Guide to Teaching. Here's where you can find us. You can find the podcast at librarian_guide. You can find Jessica at librarygeek611. You can find me, Amanda, at historybuff820. And you can always email us at infolitteachingpodcast@gmail.com. Be sure to rate and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen. We would love to hear from you in the reviews as well.